Since we're doing it live.
Yeah. Alice wants to introduce us.
Oh my god, guys, we're halfway through the season.
And Micah and Kate. Hello?
Hello.
Hello?
Better yet, Eric, here you go, okay? We're 35 episodes into Game of Thrones in its entirety, and we finally have the answer, going all the way back to episode one, of who killed Jon Arryn.
That was crazy.
Can I just say that I'm glad that we have 35 hours so far, and not three movies, or two movies, or yes, five, or four.
TV is a great format for this show, as we said before. But Kate, I wanted to bring up something that you had just said about it being crazy. I think crazy.
Good transition.
I think crazy describes a lot of Liza Arryn. I would like to apply that word to all the other aspects of her being and existence.
Yeah, no kidding. I use that word on this show quite a bit. I've realized I should probably, when I sometimes I re-listen to
expand the
show to the
vocabulary.
See how
you should
stupid.
Save it for the really crazy people.
I
know.
Need
a glossary?
Well, that's the thing. I do. I think I might need a glossary because you guys will pull that up on another window.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Liza takes the crazy crown.
Are you sure about
Absolutely.
That?
Crazy crown?
I do. I do think she wins the crazy throne.
Okay. Well,
I mean, tell me if we've got anybody else. There are some crazy people.
First of his name was full of crazies.
Yes, first of his name was full of crazies.
She takes the cake.
Let's talk about this because this was a major revelation, right?
Well, do we jump right into it? Is that how we do it? I mean, is everyone okay? Seatbelts buckled,
Micah? I think we are.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm so, you know what?
Tell us.
I'm shocked that this was not more of a big deal because
it's a big deal to me, bud.
I'm glad it's a big deal to you.
Yeah.
Because I didn't see the reaction that I was expecting, and I know it's kind of a smaller note in the grand scheme of things, but this is the entire driving point behind the series. This is why we're here right now, is because Baelish told batshit insane Liza Arryn to poison her husband, and to not only do that, but to send a letter to her sister saying that she suspected it was the Lannisters.
Mm-hmm.
The whole series was set into motion by Peter Baelish.
Is it wrong that I feel like our whole podcast is a lie?
Yeah.
Because when we started 215
episodes of lies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mike is like, oh, Baelish is a good player in Game of Thrones. And we're like, this is going to be a fun podcast to do with you, Micah. And now Baelish is the – I mean, we all assumed that he was, you know, that he was doing good things. And we all always knew that Varys and himself were powerful people. And I always – like we knew last week that Baelish did this with Joffrey. And can we say how impressive that already was, right?
Oh, very much.
Like,
yes.
Great. And what he's done with rising up from where he lived in the Fingers – to becoming who he is now, Lord Baelish, getting greeted at the Bloody Gate, right? This is it's impressive. But Micah, when you say that this man began it all, that quite possibly his ruminations of, oh, the Lannisters are so bad, they're trying to get you, let's just start all these things happening. Ned, please help. It's all from this guy, like cue evil music, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can now blame everything that has happened in the show on Baelish in some small part.
Oh, man.
It's masterful.
Especially to the Starks, because of Ned being asked to fill Jon Arryn's position as Hand. So that's just it. And my question kind of coming out of the episode was, really, what did Littlefinger offer Liza Arryn to kill her husband? What could she possibly have wanted that would make her do that? It's her husband.
She loves him, though. Look.
She loves
him. Yeah. Well, look, the coolest thing I think out of Liza Arryn is the big impact that she made after being off for three seasons, right? She comes back in such a big, big way. She's absolutely crazy, but she's also so brilliant. She doesn't miss a trick. She knows that Baelish has crazy hots for Sansa for some reason. And she calls at least Sansa out on it in this episode. She's crazy, but also astute in all the worst ways possible. You think that you could pull the lid over her eyes, but apparently you can't. And so she is just a force that's going to be difficult to be really controlled or reckoned with. Baelish is playing with fire in marrying her, I believe. And he always was, because she's unstable to, you know, really manipulate her the way
right.
that he is.
I mean, if you think about it, he's orchestrated almost a perfect plan, because he's married the one woman who sits up in the Eyrie and is so easily the most protected woman in possibly all of the Seven Kingdoms. You know, the Eerie is impenetrable for all we know. Baelish, if anybody finds out any component of what he's been responsible for, he's safe. I mean, it's just such a masterful plan that he has orchestrated. And I go back.
Are you all right, buddy?
Everything is his fault.
Just let it out, okay? That moody music that you heard the second after Lysa was just very happily making out with his face and saying, like, oh, I put the poison in the drink and my husband. Just after all of that, it just slowly crept, dawned. Everything happened all at once. It was like, this bastard is not just Peter Baelish from Game of Thrones, from A Song of Ice and Fire that we thought he was. Now at this point, he's Peter Baelish, the guy who did all of this shit. I know I've said that before, but let's let this sink in. He literally started this friction between the Lannisters and the Starks. Maybe not at the root, obviously not. But in a modern sense, turning into what all it has become, he was there every step of the way, including with Ned being at King's Landing, the stuff with this Kingsguard. The list really goes on, and it started with his manipulation of Lysa Arryn, which is so full and complete, as we can see here, marrying her tonight.
I have a quote from my notes that I'd like to read here, please. It says, he is the fakest bastard ever, and that's all. You notice how he didn't kiss her back until she started spilling all of his secrets?
Yeah, and he's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, he kissed her to shut her up. He's like, you're telling the viewers everything. Yeah. Stop.
Not even they can
I'll
know.
Stop you with my tongue. Yeah, he absolutely just had, he's so dispassionate towards her. It's a little ridiculous, but in a really, he pulls it off. She's so blinded, I think, by her affection for him or her obsession with him, whichever it is, whichever you prefer to choose, that she believes, I guess she must believe, that he is faithful enough to marry.
I don't know if she believes that. I mean, the guy owns a whorehouse.
As soon as it's convenient for him to leave her, I think he will.
I don't think that we're meant to think that this is a romantic relationship in any stretch of the imagination for any side. We're meant to think that Lysa is Lysa, as she's always been, and Baelish is very, very easily playing her this entire time.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the things that's really important about this relationship is that she sees her being able to marry Baelish as one-upping her sister, and that is very apparent in her conversation with Sansa. She talks very much about Kat, and I thought it was interesting that this episode, Kat kind of got a lot of love, albeit not in a very nice way, but she was brought up quite a bit, and it's clear that her sister never really thought very highly of her because of the relationships that she was able to get involved with. And she mentioned Brandon Stark, who was, you know, Ned's brother, who Catelyn was initially engaged to. And then, of course, Baelish. Even though Catelyn was never really taken with Baelish, it seems like that's the way Lysa perceived it. You know, Catelyn could have had the great Peter Baelish, but she chose not to, you know. And I actually thought for a minute that Sansa was in trouble in that scene because she's just sitting there eating her lemon cakes, and who the hell knows, with all the poison that Lysa's been responsible for in her life,
that's true.
She didn't go ahead and poison Sansa.
Isn't it ironic that George R. Martin made Lysa the one who really did it? Because when there's a murder, don't cops usually go first towards the spouse? I mean, the spouse is the most obvious choice because she has the most unfettered access to him.
Can I share with you my Peter Baelish and Varys theory?
Please.
Please.
Before we move too far away from Peter and toward Lysa and Sansa, which is a great scene, I was thinking about this today. I was thinking about how Varys is actually the one in the earlier season who meets with Illyrio to send Daenerys her dragon eggs. So you can extrapolate from that he is in some way supporting Daenerys Targaryen's cause.
Hold, please. When did Varys have anything to do with the dragon eggs?
He meets with when Arya is in, she's chasing cats in the first season. There's a scene where she eavesdrops on two people. They are with hanging out with all the dragon skulls. And it is Illyrio, who was Daenerys's caretaker at the time, and mm-hmm. Varys, and they are organizing the delivery of these dragon eggs, if I recall correctly.
Just wow. I know who Illyrio is, obviously, but I didn't know that that was Illyrio. This changes everything.
Right. So, because I was thinking about, I said a few episodes ago that one of my theories was that Peter's new friends that he mentions were mm-hmm. Daenerys and her entourage, but I don't think that's true. I think that's Varys's territory. But then that got me thinking about the differences and the comparisons between Varys and Peter. And then I had this amazing revelation because I was thinking, well, maybe they're two sides of the same coin. And so that coin, what if that reminded me of Arya's little coin? This takes some leaps, guys. Just okay. Stay with me.
Okay.
Kate had a vision quest.
Her coin. I did. But her coin says Valar Morghulis on it. All men must die.
True.
And then I had this revelation that if Valar Morghulis could apply to Peter, then Valar Dohaeris, which means all men must serve, is what applies to Varys. And that means they're two sides of that flip greeting.
Oh, that's interesting.
All men must serve.
Yeah.
Peter Baelish.
Yeah, that's some level 9 stuff right there.
I totally like that. I wonder if neither of them can live while the other survives as well.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, we learned that in the first book.
Yeah. I really like that point that Kate just brought up, though, being the two sides of the same coin, because Varys is all about serving. You know, he mm-hmm. mentions that so yeah. many times throughout
the
series.
Realm. Yeah.
Everything is for the good of the realm. Yeah. And if you go back all the way to season one, there is at least one great scene where you have Varys, I combined the two of them, Varys and Baelish in the throne room, and they're just talking to each other, and it's such a power conversation, you know, as they stare up at the Iron Throne, and you can't help but think this is something that only the TV show can do, because you in the first book, at least we know, you don't see from either of their perspectives. So unless you happen to be a little fly on the wall and
or chasing a cat,
overhearing yeah what is being said, this is one of those opportunities that the TV show affords that the books just can't, because that's just not the way that they were written. So these two are just unbelievable power players. And for Baelish, you know, we talked a couple episodes back that he just wants everything. And so I do mm-hmm. think the all men must die is applicable to him, because he doesn't care who gets in his way.
Exactly.
I think Varys is a little bit more tactical, and he's less apt to kill. He'll only kill when necessary, not just to kill for killing's sake.
I just realized that we've gone this entire way in the episode without really saying first of his name. That happened, and the entire thing was pretty insane, right? I mean, we got to see a whole lot, but it just goes to show something that's so impactful. I mean, at least for us, bringing Game of Thrones, the podcast, to you, I know that when this episode was happening, I rewound it and was like digitally rewatching the part where Lysa was talking to Baelish and admitting what was happening, because I didn't see that coming at all. And this entire setup with Baelish, like I said before, I know it's a little surprising, but for me, knowing all of this, it just makes the story that much richer and gives us someone else to sort of think about. When he was walking toward the Bloody Gate with Sansa, and that entire, I mean, it just felt like it is a new episode and it is a new part of the show. It just feels like Game of Thrones is really growing up and evolving into a completely different show. And that's a show that has Sansa at the Vale.
There was an interesting parallel there between the scene that was directly previous to that, which was Daenerys, who we haven't talked about yet, and she got her ships from Dario.
Yes.
That she pretended like she didn't want.
He heard
but
that
she totally
liked
did.
Them.
I saw this great gift today where she like she's looking down. She's like, "Damn, he's right. I fucking love ships."
That's good.
So she decides she's going to stay in Westeros and rule. But they make, you know, they tell her 10,000 men on all of these ships, it might be enough to take King's Landing, but not enough to hold it. And then they go directly from that to Peter and Sansa approaching the Bloody Gate. And Peter uses that exact number. He says, he's giving her the lowdown on why they have the Bloody Gate. He's like, one man can be as effective as 10,000. And then he goes right through the gate no problem, as though he is his own army. I thought that was a really interesting parallel. They use the same number so close together, as if like Peter Baelish doesn't need the Unsullied, doesn't need no ships. He's just going to walk right through the bloody gate.
I mean, that's essentially what he's done, right, this entire time. That whole metaphor there is basically saying, if you know how to use your strengths well and to use them within the bounds of what is right, which he says is wisely, if you know how to use them wisely, you can be as effective as 10,000 men. So if you think about what he's done and all the shifts that he's caused personally, I'm going to go ahead and say 4.5 seasons worth of stuff. I think he's done the work of maybe 3,000 men so far. Can we say that?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He's done the work of a lot. Yeah.
Quite a few.
One other thing to note is that she now goes by the name of Elaine Stone, right? She's no longer Sansa Stark.
That could have been a little bit clearer about Stone, especially as a surname. And why even introduce Sansa to Robin by saying, this is your cousin Sansa, but don't call her that while while she's, you know, just out and about. Why not just call her Elaine and have him know her as that? You know, it's like, it's Sansa, but only say that name when it's between us. But there are so many people lurking in the shadows all the time. Think of Locke and lurking in on Sam and John, John in the previous chapter. Like, he won't have the fortitude to judge when he's alone and is safe to call her Sansa. So I have a little issue with the whole Elaine thing, but I'm sure it was better in the books.
Well, in the books, he was, I believe Sansa was portrayed as his bastard daughter. And in the show, they changed it to his niece.
Bastard
so
niece.
I don't know. Is she a bastard niece? He never. I was trying to make sure when I was watching. I was like, is she going to be a bastard again? Because I think in the book, Lysa used that as more snobbery over Sansa.
Yeah, Stone being the bastard surname of the Vale,
right?
Which is awesome. But at the same time, yeah, like what exactly is the relationship there? And if Sansa's like undercover, I think maybe that'll come into play later episodes.
I mean, there are worse places to be and have your identity discovered, though, because at the end of the day, they are up in the Eyrie.
It's somewhat of a toxic relationship, though, I would say, for Sansa, because even though she's safe, she's really not.
She's really
Lysa
not.
Is batshit crazy.
Oh, God, yes.
And we saw that in their conversation. When Baelish is around, it's all lovey-dovey, right? But when once you get Sansa one-on-one, there was no reason to think she wasn't going to kill her right then and there.
Well, doesn't she have cause to be alarmed? I mean, Baelish had 3 crates of lemons sent there from King's Landing just for Sansa because she likes the lemon pies.
I'm going to send you 3 crates of lemons, man. How's that sound?
Oh, you shouldn't have, Zach. I'll have garnish for my drinks for years to come.
It is Cinco. After all,
oh, I think Cinco.
Peter and Lysa are both projecting Lady Catelyn onto Sansa, and it's very unfair that Sansa is having to bear the burden of what her mother did or didn't do in the past. But it doesn't matter because both of these crazy ass people see Catelyn in Sansa and are taking out their past lusts and prejudices against her.
That's really good analysis. I like that a lot.
I do too.
Well, people keep talking about how Sansa's like going to flourish soon, I hope, you know, really turn into the person who plays the game very well. And I'd like to see what sort of circumstances really allow her to stretch her legs a little bit more, because she is kind of confined. I mean, we even saw the room where she sleeps, and look, it just looks pretty small. Maybe all the rooms in the Eyrie are like that, but it did look a little like she was being confined and is not really going to have a whole lot of power where she is. And this is just guesses from, you know, the first sort of introduction to the Eyrie that we saw.
Have you guys thought about, Lady Catelyn's been dead for a while. Have you guys given any thought to the fact that Peter Baelish was in love with her and he might be super pissed off at the people who murdered her?
Yeah. I thought about that, but he's just not somebody who projects aggression. He doesn't, like, if he gets angry, but you almost never see it, right? I totally expect to hear in the background in the next couple episodes that somebody, dropped a nuke on the twins. Like, I just, I totally expect nuclear weapons to have been invented in secret by the maesters over at the Harrenhal or whatever underground, and that all of a sudden there are no more Freys. You know how many Freys there are all the time. Old Walder, Young Walder, Big Walder, Little Walder,
Middle Walder.
All of them just – all of them
don't forget
just,
Middle Walder. Yeah.
Middle Walder, yes. All of them just immolated somehow, and it's Baelish's doing. I wouldn't be surprised. So, yes, that's a very exciting possibility, I think, because a lot of the – and the readers and the viewers would want that kind of revenge for the Starks, for Catelyn, not just for Catelyn, but for Robb too, because he was king in the North, man, and now the North is all messed up as a result of his death.
Everything's
all
messed
so
up.
So if Baelish can be the avenging angel here for all of the Starks, that would be delicious.
Can we just talk about what we're talking about? I want to talk about what we're talking about, if that makes sense. Calm down, Kate.
Yes. Zach, go for it.
I want to talk about the fact that we're talking about Baelish. I mean, do you guys remember season one Baelish, like, puffing around beside Varys, like, getting slammed up against a whorehouse by Ned, and, like, she sticks her head out the window. Kat's like, Ned, let him go. He's my friend. I think of him like a brother. We're talking about Baelish right now as someone who could drop a nuke on the Freys. I mean, just instantly, he's changed in the minds of so many people. It's just, to me, it's just, I agree with you, Micah. I don't understand how this isn't more of a deal to the masses.
Yeah. I think because it goes so fast in the show.
It did.
Micah, I actually wanted to bring it back to Micah because she says it. She says, you know, I killed John, I killed my husband. And that was over 3 years ago that we saw that happen, if we're watching chronologically. So I think most viewers were like, well, everybody's dying on the show. Who the hell knows who her husband is?
Right.
But
was he one of those seven bearded men they introduced in the last 5 minutes of this show?
Right, exactly. Like, any of those guys died? Like, there's just so much death. There's so many characters. I think that if you're not paying very, very close attention, you'd be like, oh, yeah, he had her kill a dude. That's
well,
crazy.
I don't know if that's an execution problem on behalf of the show itself. It's tough to say because for me, I know the feeling of realizing that there is an overarching sort of puppeteer villain to a lot of this stuff, and it's all the same guy. To me, it just makes it that much richer.
If it's any consolation, this is exactly how it happens in the book.
Oh, that's
it is one line of dialogue, and she gets interrupted, and they move on.
I'm just stoked about it. And Micah, hats, shoes, feet, coats off to you, man. Pants off to you for sticking around for this long. Now you can leave the fucking show, man. So say bye to everybody.
Oh, but there are plenty more things to come. What are you talking about?
Tell your father.
I just would want to just add one more thing. I thought it was somewhat interesting. I wouldn't call it symbolic because I don't necessarily know what it symbolizes just yet, but the fact that little Robin took the Mockingbird and threw it out of the moon door. Did anybody else catch that?
That little prick.
Such a little shithead.
I wanted them to show Baelish's face to see if he cared.
Right. I know,
just to shoot him to see if he would smirk, how he would take it. Yeah, that was great.
Wait, was it a mockingbird or was it a...
I thought it was a dove.
I thought it was
a dove. It's a thing that you can balance on the end of your finger perfectly.
It's a turtle dove. It was that I have one and you have one. And as long as we hold on to it, we'll be friends forever.
Turtle I assumed doves. It was a falcon. The sigil of
House Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Oh, book readers.
Well,
now that's symbolic.
It had plumage. It was fake, but it was meant to be. It was like a crystal glass gift, and he threw it out of the... creaked open slightly moon door, and we've had much to say about other stuff, and we've hinted at other people so far on the podcast, and we really haven't talked
about
much
else.
Yeah,
there was more to the show, right?
Yeah, there was more to the show. But before we move on, blah blah blah, can I just say out loud that we were back in that room where Bronn fought for Tyrion for the first time, and that was cool.
Yeah, especially that's having true. Been kind of mentioned in a previous episode by Bronn to Jaime. It's just bringing back the season one stuff and showing that it's still important.
But it was done well. It was done quickly, but done well, much like Lysa screams. But
that was perfect. That was just perfect. I mean, in all of the
so
mountains,
creepy. So
the
creepy,
mountain
guys.
Folk, the mountain folk must be intimidated by her.
Shaga is wondering what's going on up in the Eyrie. But
wait.
I don't even know where to take it from here.
I know where to go from there.
Let's just say I'm going to scream when I make love to my husband. Oh.
Well, at least, unlike Sansa, they consummated their marriage, and they did it pretty quick.
Don't be jealous, Sansa. You'll be a widow soon.
That actress, right. I think her name is Kate Dickey. What an incredible performance.
Oh,
she is such
yes.
a good Lysa.
That face, that holy first smile crap. When Baelish walked in, she was like, oh
boy. Ew. It was just like, all over the place, and so that was crazy. The best thing about it is that that character has such a range of emotions and a range of, I mean, she's dangerous, she's sweet, she's in it, she's vulnerable, she's all these things all at once, mm-hmm. and it's just, it was really, again, just coming back from season one into the middle of season four now with such an impact, and I really can't have any higher praise for that actress. She was amazing. So going from the moaning mountains to old sweaty balls, if we can, Maester Pycelle climbing the stairs to pay his respects to Tommen, who is being sworn in. And everybody, in fact, who is attending the swearing-in ceremony has to go up and kind of bow before him.
Pledge your fealty, okay?
Do mm-hmm. it.
And he gets his special secret moment with Margaery.
A few of them.
She smiles at him. And then Cersei just blocks the entire camera.
What up, Mom?
Yeah, that was funny.
That was some serious boner killer. Yeah, I thought that was really funny. Cersei was interesting this episode, you guys.
Different.
Cersei has been such a maniac in the last, I don't know, 35 years of her life. But in this episode, she, and I know she had an ulterior motive, but it was really interesting to watch her knock it out.
Did anybody notice who she visited?
What do you
yes.
mean?
Yes.
Who were the people that she visited? Very strategic.
She was totally strategic. She visited the, not directly in one case, but she was visiting all the judges in Tyrion's case and trying to win them over. She visited Margaery and offered to make her queen again, which is a backhanded way of getting at Mace. She visited Tywin and agreed to marry Loras, no problem. I'm going to marry him 2 weeks when she's previously thrown a hissy fit every single time he brings up the marriage. And then she visited Oberyn. And while she knows Oberyn thinks that her family had something to do with the death of his sister, she very sweetly tells him how much she misses her daughter. She wants to believe that everything's good with her and she's going to give her a ship as a birthday present.
Why not?
And She loves her daughter so much, and she just wants to be a great mom. And she's appealing to all three of these men in very strategic ways, just
wow.
because she wants to see mm-hmm. Tyrion hang.
Again, I'm floored. I mean, I was just – all I wrote down for that
Kate's
scene
on
between
another level.
Yeah.
Cersei and Margaery – I don't think that much has been clear since the first word that each of us shared. But I, if I could just bow to you, but also at the same time, what I said about Cersei in my notes was that she's doing what she hates doing the most. There's a line that she says, speak to your father, I'll speak to mine.
Oh.
She has vehemently been against the notion of the role of women in this kingdom. She complains about it all the time, how they are not given any agency, how they're just treated like possessions, how they're doing essentially what she's doing right now about having to speak to her father about arranged marriage,
yep.
you know, and all this other junk. And she hates that. She hates the kind of woman she's being right now, and seeing her have to do it because she's trying to, as you say, Kate, appease the judges, is very interesting. Mm-hmm. She wants Tyrion out of the picture that badly. And at this point, it seems, I want to say like a broken record, because it's really not. There's not much of that show. But every time she gets an opportunity to complain about Tyrion, she does. And it's something like she's just not open to any other options that anybody else could have killed him.
She really wants him dead. We're pretty sure of that by now, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, without question.
I mean, like,
I think
like,
that
damn.
It's sad, though, in a way, because there really is no evidence at all that Tyrion is responsible for this. And that's the worst part. I mean, he's going to face a trial, but I'm interested to see what exactly the proof is that Tyrion had any responsibility in all this, because so far we've seen nothing, and it's just Cersei's word. And she seems set in her ways, but I liked the conversation that she had with Margaery, and I think that in some ways she was being truthful. in all of those conversations, actually, I think there was a bit of truth. I think she obviously does care very much for Myrcella when she was talking with Oberyn.
Right.
And she wants to ensure that she's safe. And she's lost Joffrey. And Myrcella's her only daughter. And she feels as if her children are extremely susceptible given the positions that they're in. And then I think there was truth to Joffrey when she was talking with Margaery, when she was saying that he would have been your nightmare. The things he did shocked me. I don't think those were lies. I don't think she was just saying them just to kind of play the game and you know, play up the potential to marry Tommen. I think she truly believed that about her son.
But it's so weird how she can be so pro Joffrey in one scene and against him in the other.
I don't think that she was lying, Micah. I think you're totally correct. However, I do think that Cersei plays cards as she sees them being necessary. And in this case, she had she had reason to say those things, to confide these things to Margaery and to confess things to Oberyn. And she has not, even if she believed those things in the past, she doesn't speak out against her family.
Yeah.
And in doing these things, she's speaking out against Joffrey. And so I think that she would, in other situations, just keep her mouth shut or actively defend.
That's true. She approached Margaery, and it wasn't to berate her or say, stop looking at my son. You know, it wasn't to threaten her. She must be up to something. Furthermore, Margaery fed her that load of bull. Actually, I haven't given it much thought, honestly, to being
queen.
I've
only been sneaking into his bedroom.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Such BS. Such BS. And I think Cersei knows it, but maybe there was even a shot of her, like, smirking for, like, half a second. But she totally, like, pretended to believe what Margaery was telling her. You're right, Kate. She was up to something.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how I missed it.
Margaery was definitely the more Cersei of the two of them in that scene. Actually, now that I'm reflecting on it, because Margaery, she lied, and she was doing the, like, the acid tongue lady at court thing, especially at the end when she goes, I won't know whether to call you sister or mother. And Cersei's, oh, yeah, like, biting her tongue. She's like, don't fucking say anything. Just let it go.
Gotta
but
keep
Margaery,
cool.
Margaery knows what she's doing.
I think we're used to seeing Cersei, her mark of pride is so, just, it's the flag is flown. She very rarely lets anything go. Her pride just really drives her. And in a lot of these scenes in this episode, she bit that tongue and she didn't say the things that she wanted to say. She was actually nice. And I guess if her being even slightly nice is her version of playing the game, it's an improvement, right? I mean, she's getting closer to her goal. Probably.
I think the hints were there, though. Kate did a really amazing job of explaining exactly what Cersei was up to, but I could go back to that scene with Oberyn and Cersei, because Oberyn's talking about his daughter and how one of them, one of his seven daughters, I think, right?
Eight
daughters, is named Elia after his sister. And there's that moment where he says, you know, when I think about it, it makes me very sad. But then that sadness turns to anger. And that's really what Cersei's doing here. You know, she's sad over the death of her son, and it's transforming into anger. And that's what she's using to motivate herself to go after Tyrion. So Oberyn and Cersei's paths here are not that dissimilar. You know, Oberyn's looking to avenge the death of his sister and his niece and his nephew, and Cersei's looking to avenge the death of her son. Mm-hmm. And those two are kind of in sync with each other in that conversation right there. And I'll be honest, I completely missed it. Kate, you're the man.
Or girl.
Thank you.
Woman.
What good is power if you can't protect the ones you love, guys?
We've talked about Cersei and Oberyn there briefly. We've talked about Cersei and Margaery. Let's talk about Cersei and Tywin. Because in this scene, I felt Tywin opened up to Cersei more than he ever has before.
Yes, very true. It was a lot of transparency about the delicate situation that the Lannisters are in and exactly why they need to tie themselves to the Tyrells.
Yeah, and that's huge. Obviously, all the bank stuff, which is totally going to – I feel like it's almost too obvious that it's coming in this season. But still, I mean, obviously that's a big conversation.
Minus
but
the preview for next week's episode.
Yeah, forget that.
I still haven't seen it yet.
All that aside, I think Mark Gatiss is going to be amazing on this show. But – So regarding Tywin, though, do you think it's just because one of his sons is in prison and the other son is, I don't want to say excommunicated. Even Cersei says that. She's like the only one he's got left, almost. And it's not confrontational. And he is confiding in her like he would one of his sons, but he doesn't have his sons anymore, like, on his side.
Yeah, it was a really weird scene. The more I've thought about it today, the more I feel like I don't understand Tywin's motivation, because there's a motivation behind everything that Tywin does. He doesn't trust Cersei. He knows that she's crazy. He knows that she wants to kill Tyrion. He doesn't necessarily agree that that's the right course of action, or Tyrion would probably already be dead. But he also is showing the side of him like, hey, we don't have any gold. We actually have only power, and we need to supplement that power with gold, or we're going to be SOL, because everybody knows Casterly Rock is full of gold, and guess what? We don't have any now. So yeah, that was a really interesting scene, and I am holding out to find out why Tywin would have confessed that. I don't think it was a soft spot for Cersei that did it. I think there's something else.
I think that it's a setup just in general for Braavos and for the Iron Bank. We've heard it talked a lot about this season.
It's true.
By a number of different characters. And I think even going to the scenes between Arya and the Hound, right? We got a call back to Braavos yet again in this episode with Cyrio Forel making an appearance in memoriam.
there you go.
When Arya talks about him with the Hound. And it was kind of a funny scene, but you could also tell that Arya was getting very, very upset and very frustrated. And that's why she tries to stab the Hound in the stomach with needle, and it did absolutely no good.
That was a very confident jab. I think it was too confident.
I think she was pretty fired up. But that actually led to one of my favorite lines of the show, which was the Hound saying, "Your friend's dead and Meryn Trant's not. Because Trant had armor and a big fucking sword."
Yeah, he's training her. Without agreeing to train her, without any formal arrangement that he would train her, he tries to pretend that he doesn't care about her. She's learning anyway, at the very least, just by him pushing her down. It's training for her. She will get back up again.
He punches her right in the head.
Yeah. I mean,
it's more than a push.
I'm thinking about when she was naming the names and the stuff with the Iron Bank. I'm sure we're going to have more time to revisit on Friday, because there's just so much to talk about. But with her reading off the names, and he was like, "Are you going to read off the names of every fucking person in Westeros or whatever?" I mean, can we just talk about the beautiful decision when they were making the episode to go, okay, well, Arya's going to say the Hound with attitude. That'll be funny. Everyone's like, yeah, duh, that's good. That'll be good. But the shot of the Hound looking at her after that, the look on his face, Rory McCann really pulled that off very well. I liked it. It said a lot. It didn't say, "I'm scared of you." It didn't say, "I'm not scared of you." It said, "You said my name." You know what I mean? I liked it. It just rounded the whole thing out.
I think he was impressed.
Maybe.
I think more than anything else, he was like, "All right, kid, you got guts. You got balls on you."
I still have to say the best reaction to her naming a name was Jack and Hagar, though. "One wishes to be unnamed. Please unname me."
That was pretty good.
Freaking out. But the Hound was just like, "Hey, look, is she going to do it tonight? No, probably not, because she still needs me." I think that's what he was thinking in those wee hours of the night.
He was a bit impressed, but I think at the same time he was also a bit disappointed, because I think he feels like he's protected her in some way these last – yeah, I don't. A couple months, let's say, when they've been on the road together, and there's a different side to the Hound. Yeah, he's this crazy killer I don't know what else to call
psycho
him.
Psycho killer.
It was interesting because I was reading an article in the New York Times about Game of Thrones. It's actually the article that was written about the Jaime Cersei rape and the raping of Craster's daughters that took place last week when we were at Craster's Keep, but they mentioned the fact of how characters from Game of Thrones, you know, especially there's no real good and evil. There's just sort of like everybody has different degrees, but how there's this ability to endear these characters to you, even though they're somewhat bad. I mean, there's no way to, you know, kind of divide it up. Like these people are inherently bad people, but there's still something about it them that draws you to them and it makes you sympathetic towards them. I feel like the Hound is one of those characters.
Definitely.
I mean, his relationship with Arya has been his saving grace for a long time because, I mean, he was a different character in the first season.
Yeah. I mean, he's been protector of both Sansa and now Arya. And, you know, I think that's more or less why we like him for all of his other faults. And it seems like he's becoming more comfortable with Arya, too. He's talked a little bit more in each of the last few episodes about the relationship he has with his brother.
Yeah, he really went into it this episode.
Well, speaking of pairs, we did talk about Arya and the Hound, but we should get over to Brienne and Pod, who had a series of scenes in this episode. And there was a flaming rabbit.
There was. I was not into the Brienne and Pod scenes. And you guys know how much I love Brienne and Pod.
I thought it started out with Podrick like riding into a tree like he didn't know how to use his mouse. You know, like that's yeah. How you steer.
Like, come on, Pod. I expect a little more out of Pod.
Right.
And I also didn't like how Brienne was kind of like holier than thou. She really looked down her nose at Podrick for no good reason. She was just, I guess she was just annoyed that he was there at all. But it seems like she does a really good job of sucking up to people who are highborn and not so good at like dealing with people who are lesser than she is, I suppose. But I was just, their chemistry, she does grow some respect for him when he tells her that he murdered a Kingsguard. She's like, oh, okay, you kill people. That's pretty cool. But up until that point, it was just this bumbling, like weird comedy stuff. And I wasn't into it.
I think it was just thrown in there so that it shows that she wasn't just automatically, oh, Pod, you're the best ever, so that she can grow to like him. I think that's kind of what this...
Everybody knows that Pod's the best ever.
Well, it makes lot of sense, though, because she probably understands where he came from, at least. And in her mind, you know, he just got finished telling her. She was like, so what did you do for Tyrion? And he said, basically, at the end of the day, I poured a lot of wine. Like,
yeah.
And I guess the problem with it all is exactly what you said. She didn't really give him the time of day to learn anything about him. So she had all these preconceived notions and judged him. And I just think that once she realized that if she was nice and she opened up a little bit, I mean, she learned so much more about Podrick. And then, you know, the shift did take place. But, I mean, a lot of it did fall on her shoulders for just being an ass at first.
I wonder if we would even, if that would be, and this is a question I'm asking myself first and foremost, but I wonder if it would have bothered me if Brienne had been a male character, because we see this dynamic between male characters all the time where an older, wiser male character is just a jerk to a younger male or female character. Arya and the Hound is a really good example. It's funny when the Hound is a dick to Arya, but it's not funny when Brienne is a dick to Pod. I don't know. It's that's an interesting, like, why am I expecting that she should be nice just simply because she's a woman? I don't know. I just think it's because I love Pod.
I think that we expect Brienne to know better. We know that she's an intelligent person, and we've seen her in a mix of different emotional situations in the show, and I just think that we expect more from her.
Yeah.
I agree 100% with that, Zach. I think that we do expect more of her, and the fact that she was kind of looking down her nose at Pod, I think it's probably more so that she just doesn't want Pod there.
And she didn't want to leave.
She's just a very independent person, and I think that she views her commitment to Catelyn as being hers and hers alone, and she's also being saddled with Pod, and she may not necessarily like Tyrion and like the things that he's done in the past. And, you know, she knows a lot of the history that's gone on, and we know Tyrion's not really a bad guy, but we're not really sure how much she's been informed about him. And so to have his squire, who seems like, you know, he's not very competent,
riding a horse into a tree.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. But I think Pod is going to grow on Brienne.
He cooked sure the did. Rabbit with the fur still on.
Yeah, look, I was skeptical about the whole Pod and Brienne side story thing in the recent episodes because I just don't care all that much for Pod. And I've said this before. He's got a nice smile. I'll give him that. But beyond that, he really hasn't, besides saving Tyrion's life, he's kind of just a Tyrion side character. He belongs in Tyrion's, the back of the room whenever Tyrion's having a scene. And now it's going to be that way for Brienne. But more pressing than my dislike for Brienne and Pod altogether was the fact that Brienne is looking in the wrong place for Sansa.
Oh my god, that bothered me so much. Why is she going all the way to the north? When you look at a map of Westeros, the Eyrie is like right there.
They don't have the maps that we have of Westeros, I don't think. Yeah, apparently, but that's the thing is, you were right, Kate, in a recent episode, you said, oh, she would probably go for the next of kin or the family member, like the closest surviving relative, which right. we said is Lyza, but she's actually looking for Jon, who's almost half a relative, technically.
I was very disappointed. I was like, come on, Brienne.
So it's the right idea. It's the right idea, but the wrong person. And we just don't need any more people at the wall is what I want to say. Like, get away. Get away from the wall. The wall is the new King's Landing. Freaking everybody's going to be there.
No, but Eric's right. The wall, I've kind of had it. It's just, it's I white. Love There's Brienne people wearing up. Black. All right. All right. Fine. You know what? I will give it another shot. I'll watch the episode again and try not to be...
Daniel Portman's grimace that turned into a smile once Brienne asked him to help with the armor. I was just, Pod, you are the most loyal squire this show's ever filmed.
Do you guys watch Downton Abbey?
Not yet.
There is a scene where a butler is being rebuffed by someone who doesn't want himself to be dressed by the butler.
Whoa, and spoiler.
Then... I know. It's pretty crazy. It's off the chain. But then the highborn guy decides that he does to give this guy something to do because that's his job. And he looks so heartbroken. And so he's like, sure, you can come dress me. And the guy just lights up. His face totally lights up. It's exactly the same.
It's like Mr. Deeds.
I'm going to start a Downton Abbey podcast. You guys are not invited.
Good luck with that.
I have a question about Danny that I wanted to bring up to Micah and Kate, who have read the books. Because, Micah, I think you alluded to or said outright that the siege of Meereen takes a little bit longer in the books. So now having to go back to Yunkai or Astapor, the fact that they basically threw in this episode that those governments, the council she installed has fallen and that slaves have been retaken by their masters. And she's got all of this kind of work to do now in kind of keeping the kingdom that she has so far. So is that the show's way of keeping her busy indefinitely in those parts? Because it's obviously too soon for her to come over to Westeros.
I don't know if we can comfortably answer that question.
Because it's a spoiler or what? Like, my only question is, did it really take forever to siege Meereen in the books?
It took a long time.
Yeah.
So George R. R. Martin, I remember when he was writing this book, he referred to this section as the Meereenese Knot. And this is what he kept referring to week after week after week when he would post about, I've got this Meereenese Knot, I'm trying to untangle it. And so I think that not only was a pain in the butt for him to write, it took forever, and a bunch of different people all came to Meereen, and they had to be untangled. But anyway, all that to say, I don't think that there's much we can say without spoiling stuff.
Okay,
maybe Micah can.
Seeing as how she is now having trouble, though, keeping these...
No, but I think that's to be expected, though. I think that you can't just move from one city to another and just kind of leave a trail in your wake and hope that everything is just going to be okay. I think that, we don't necessarily know exactly, and this is probably not true because I know Ser Jorah goes through, who she's put into power in these different cities and how it's basically faltered, but it doesn't seem like she left it in all that capable hands. Mm-hmm. And so now some of the others who were down have now risen back up and are not only have regained their power but are looking to take some sort of recourse against her. So she's in a different position than she thought she would be, but it shows her ignorance on some level. She doesn't even take Ser Jorah's advice yet again when he offers it. She can't see that some of the things that she's doing aren't having the outcomes that she would like. And I think it's not just ignorance, but it's immaturity. And she shows it quite a few times. And, her line about, I will rule, she whines. She's a whiner. She needs to shut up.
She's learning. She's a teenage girl, right? And she's learning a very valuable lesson. If she wants to rule Westeros, she certainly has to rule these cities capably.
Well, you know, that actually somebody commented on that to me earlier. Like, obviously they're aged up a little bit in the show, but in the books, even more so, you know, kind of a young girl on a power trip is how Dany is seen by some readers who've read. And now it's just, well, I just saw this as the show's way of giving her, or of giving themselves, the writers, like a blank, you know, canvas to just keep her there indefinitely mm-hmm. until the rest of the plot elsewhere catches up to when it's time for her to come over. Because they said she basically has the men to do it. You know, they said she basically has, like, the men, and she's got the ships. Thanks, Dario. You know, no thanks to you, Friendzone, meaning Jorah. But really, like, they have to keep her there because it's not time for her to come over yet. So they have these problems where cities she's already been to are revolting, and she's got to spend a couple episodes kind of figuring out how best to deal with that. It's a learning experience for her, but that way her plot isn't so accelerated. Like, as if they were pulling from future books, now they can just stop.
They probably could have drawn out her getting to Meereen and her taking the city for a little bit longer.
Without getting spoiled, hey, I'm glad that you guys answered that question, so thank you.
We tried.
You're welcome.
Kate did a better job.
As always.
Uh-huh. So
that higher plane of existence, that higher level that we're talking about. So listeners may notice that we have been leaving a crucial series of scenes out of our discussion. Actually, we've just been occupied by other discussions, but that is because we would like to devote the full and ample required amount of time to discussing Craster's Keep and all of the wonderful things that have happened there in this episode on our Friday end of the week recap kind of prehash episode.
It's a good sign, Eric, when there is so much to talk about that we can't fit into a Monday episode. It's a good sign.
Yeah.
Not just
one, it's a very good sign.
Things. Very cool.
And I think the other big thing that we'll be sure to include on Friday's episode are all of your owns from Twitter, from Facebook, from email, from Wic, all of those places. We will make sure to read what you felt was some of the best moments, funniest, sarcastic, however you constitute an own, we will read it on Friday's episode. But the one thing we do need to do before we wrap up this show.
Mo, I try it again. You made me clear my throat.
I noticed Micah, Zach now clears your throat for you. It's like a brand Hodor relationship.
But one thing we do need to do before we wrap up this episode is we need to give our owns.
Oh, gosh. I was just in my mind thinking, are we going to do a two-parter and do owns on Friday? But if we had an ownless episode, something would be wrong, right?
That's right. Okay. We have to have some.
Yeah, we gotta.
Okay, I'll do mine. I've been waiting on this. My honorary mention, which we sometimes do, goes to the swearing-in ceremony for Tommen, because there were 100% less coffee cups present at that ceremony than there were at the previous ceremony we saw. People on social media may know what I'm talking about. There was a little bit of a mix-up with a coffee cup in the last one during the wedding, but my actual own goes to Liza Aaron for owning the mountain surrounding the Eyrie. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Pretty sure everybody within 100 clicks heard that. So go her for the emotional range and the vocal range.
I thought you meant for like being the boss of the mountain.
No. No. I mean, for the vocal and emotional range of that Liza Aaron displayed in this episode. There, I did it. It wasn't a sexual that time. Okay, there you go.
All right.
That's my own.
I don't know if I can follow that up.
Let's see. What can I come up with?
Yikes.
No, I'm actually going to give my own to Dany, who's doing a little bit of self-analysis. And I think it's appropriate since we just finished talking about her. And she asked the question, how can I rule Seven Kingdoms if I can't control Slaver's Bay?
That's a good question.
That's what we've all been saying for the last 4 fucking seasons.
Wow.
I'm on your side, Dany.
My own goes to Peter Baelish for owning the entirety of Game of Thrones. Period.
Too easy.
Mic drop. You gotta say it. Somebody has to say it. I'm done.
That's it?
Yeah.
She dropped the mic drop.
Oh, yeah.
I dropped the mic.
Yeah, man. Done.
Over. Oh, yeah, Kate. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't picked out an own particularly yet because there are so many.
I got one for you.
All right, try one.
Tywin saying that King Rob used to pat him on the back a lot.
That was my own! Holy shit! I didn't like your husband. He used to pat me on the back a lot. That's my... I forgot it.
I didn't trust him.
Oh my god. Yeah. I mean, I just got too excited for that. I mean, we're all laughing. This is a strange episode of our show because we're not reading your owns. And we talked about a whole lot, and we left out, tons of the episode. There's so much more to talk about, but luckily we have that other episode later on in the week, but I don't know why I'm talking about that stuff. I'm just explaining why it's weird. Okay, listen, Tywin talking about Robert was cool. That's it. That's my own. Can someone else?
Yes. Oh, I'm done. We've exhausted all of our ability to think at this point. So
if only Brad could swoop in and take over.
I'm losing my voice, apparently. Yeah. which is never a good sign.
I'm going to drink some water for you, buddy.
Have to get some more of those margaritas for Cinco de Mayo.
We got the lemons.
Yeah, the lemons.
We have enough lemons. They should just hand out lemons at the next Game of Thrones public party that HBO hosts and be like, these are some leftover lemons because Baelish got 3 crates of them sent to the Eyrie.
Baelish hands you lemons, you...
you make lemon cakes.
So that's it, people. We've made a strange episode, but it is halfway through the season. Yeah, I meant to say through there, but I didn't. So halfway through the season, and we're allowed to make at least one weird one.
It happens.
Yeah.
So just a reminder that on Friday's episode, we will talk a lot about Bran and Hodor and all the shit that went down at Craster's. And we will be taking and reading all of your owns that have come into Twitter and Facebook and any other way you could possibly reach us. You can even send us snail mail. We do read that, but I don't know where you're going to send it because we don't even have a P.O. box or anything.
All right. It's late. Mike is tired. We're all here. Eric's here. He's still here.
I'm still here to remind you where you can get in touch with us.
Yes.
Your first stop for sending us owns is on Twitter. It's the fastest. It's the quickest. You can just tweet.
Please do that.
Right away. At Game of Owns on Twitter. You could alternately scrawl upon our wall, leave your presents, and winged glass doves or crows or what did you say it was?
Bird?
Raven?
Falcon. Definitely a bird.
Falcon?
Falcon.
What? Falcon. Leave glass falcons for us over
the
on
sigil
our
of
wall.
House Aaron.
Ooh.
Yes.
Take the
Facebook
hint, people.
Facebook.com/GameOfOwns. Or you can write us a longer format comment or concern or own anytime via our email address. Yes, the inbox still works, hasn't changed addresses or anything like that. contact@gameofowns.com. Same as it's always been. First of its name, contact@gameofowns. Also iTunes, it's a thing, yeah. And it's the month.